Grand Canyon University makes earning your degree possible with over 130 academic programs for traditional campus students, with more than 80 bachelor's programs offered online. GCU provides you with the personal support you need, from complimentary unofficial transcript evaluations within 24 business hours to scholarships, academic support, and your GCU graduation team led by your own university counselor. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I ask you to smell the defendant.
Oh, sure, like lawyers work in big skyscrapers and have secretaries. Look at him, he's wearing a belt. That's Hollywood for you.
Please answer the question. Does the defense's case hold water?
No. The defense is wrong.
Objection. Overruled.
No. No, I strenuously object.
Oh, wow. Strenuously object, then I should take some time to reconsider.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 16, coming at you early, bonus time. Isn't that awesome? How are you doing, Andrew?
I'm great, Thomas. How are you?
Well, I'd say I'm doing about as well as I could be, given that your fantasy team is slowly taking over our matchup. And we're going to record as well as two friends can with teams going at it right now as we speak.
I want everyone to know what a divide we just breached in order to get the show out to you.
Yeah, we weren't speaking to each other, but we decided. Yeah, now we wanted to record this special episode for you. There's been some Trump news. Who would have thought Trump news? You couldn't imagine, but there's been something. And as a result, Andrew had a great idea for a nice early episode for you guys. Can't wait to get to it. For that reason, we are setting aside our differences, our fantasy football differences. We both decided to, you know, wade into neutral territory here and do a recording for you guys. So let's get to our first segment, Breaking Down the Law.
Down the law. Down the law. Down the law. Down the law.
All right. Well, relevant question. I would say increasingly irrelevant question with how little chance there is of Trump winning. But Andrew, just in case, if Trump somehow won through, I don't know, mind control, massive mind time machine, some means like that, could he follow through on his promise to ban all Muslims from entering into the country?
Yeah, and this is one of those questions that has a really simple and straightforward answer. It's not what you would expect, or at least it wasn't what I expected when I went and took a look at it. And that is, yes,
wow.
Trump could follow through on his plan to ban all Muslims from emigrating into this country. The relevant section of the law here is 8 U.S.C. 1182F, which is a law that particular provision, I think, was amended in 1952, governs immigration and says the title header is suspension of entry or imposition of restrictions by president. And the law passed by Congress says whenever the president finds that the entry of any aliens or of any class of aliens into the United States would be detrimental to the interests of the United States, he may, by proclamation and for such period as he shall deem necessary, suspend the entry of all aliens or of any class of aliens as immigrants or non-immigrants, or impose on the entry of aliens any restrictions he may deem to be appropriate. So that's fairly unambiguous. As far as I know, it has never been used. Obviously, you know, 1952, that's, you know, sort of the Cold War era, early Cold War era. And I suspect that it's kind of a McCarthyite provision, but it's never been applied. There's no case law, but that is about as unambiguous as I could imagine.
Wow. And, yeah, not certainly not what I expected. I thought, I'm based on inferior coverage that's not our podcast, you know, not not in-depth opening arguments podcast coverage. I thought it was going to be a for sure the other way, you know, like, nope, can't do it. Sorry, Constitution. But sounds like,
it's okay. That's right. And if you think about the Constitution, many of the rights within the Constitution, some go to individuals, but some extend to citizens. Mm-hmm. And so in this case, as it turns out, I don't know if there's a grounds for raising a constitutional challenge to being denied the opportunity to emigrate to the U.S.
Right,
as a class.
Because you're not a citizon, huh?
Yeah. Wow, I mean, that would be a really, really hard lawsuit to bring, too. And until that would happen, you know, you would have no mechanism to declare, you know, for a court to declare the law unconstitutional. And I can't, off the top of my head, I can't think of a particular provision that would invalidate it. Now, wow. Again, remember that this is a delegation of congressional authority. So, you know, if you had the unlikely confluence of a Trump presidency plus a Democratic Congress, then the Congress could simply repeal this section, 8 U.S.C. 1182F. But that obviously seems pretty remote. But it's a good thing to remember that, you know, if you think that banning entire classes of people on the basis of ethnicity, national origin, religion is a bad thing, you know, just because, you know, in the event that Trump loses, just because he loses doesn't mean that it's not also a good idea to pressure Congress to act, to remove this provision so that it's off the books and out of the hands of whatever president in the future we might have. But this is the state of the law right now.
Wow. Breaking down the law. The law, consider it broken down. All right. Well, let's get over to our main topic for today's show. Yeah, so I don't know if you knew this, Andrew. You've been away. You've been birthdaying. Happy birthday, by the way.
Well, thank you, Thomas.
While you were away birthdaying, Donald Trump chose to have a bad news day. I think he picked that day so that you wouldn't notice because you mean a lot to him. But he, I'm sure when you woke up from your hangover the next morning, I'm sure you were pleased to find out that Trump had not had a good news day. That was Friday. It turns out there's tapes of him from 2005, kind of on a hot mic situation where he apparently didn't think it was, or maybe he didn't even care. Who knows? With Billy Bush, who we've learned is the cousin of W. So it was Access Hollywood kind of in between tapes that didn't make it to the final, shockingly enough, didn't make the final product of him saying horrendous things about women and how he basically can do whatever he wants because he's a celebrity of some kind, and really horrifying stuff. I'm sure everybody knows about it by now. Lots of stuff that I don't want to really repeat on a show like ours. Yes, even a show where the end of it is stop breaking the law, asshole. This is a bridge too far for me.
I'm with you. We have to maintain decorum on this podcast.
Yeah. So as a result, some questions arise. Questions that Andrew thought might be great to do for you guys for a bonus show because it's very timely. And in the last couple of days, we've even seen more and more Republicans dropping their support. People are urging Trump to quit. It doesn't look like he's going to as of now. He's tweeted that he wasn't going to drop out. But let's ask our expert, our resident expert, Andrew Torres, what is the law here? Can he be forced out by the GOP? Can he, what happens if he drops out? All that kind of stuff. Are they stuck with him, basically?
So let's walk through kind of step by step the process that the Republican Party would have to go through in order to replace Donald Trump as its nominee. And the first step would be formally withdrawing him as the nominee, which would require the Republican National Committee, which has 176 members, to convene a meeting. And they have promulgated rules. I'm going to link the rules in the show notes that describe the power of the RNC in this situation. So the first question you might ask is, can Donald Trump be replaced?
Yeah.
And the answer to that is, we don't know.
There's no replacing Donald Trump, but someone can try.
But here's the argument. There are two provisions that are going to be relevant that would potentially apply here. So the first is, in the RNC rules, Rule 9A says that the Republican National Committee is hereby authorized and empowered to fill any and all vacancies which may occur by reason of death, declination, or otherwise of the Republican candidate for President of the United States or the Republican candidate for Vice President of the United States as nominated at the convention. There are two positions that are in tension here. The first is that there is a catch-all phrase that says the RNC can fill any vacancy created by death, declination, or otherwise, right?
Yeah, and, otherwise. So that sounds a little broad to me. It sounds like that would be anything. And one question I might have is, what was the point of the first few words? If you, I mean, I'm sure this gets into writing these things in general, because you do see that a lot in different, I don't know, contracts or law or whatever. But why do you write the first two words if it's like, this thing, also everything else possible? You know, it seems weird that you would bother with that.
Yeah, that's a great question. And when you look in contracts, you will often see illustrative lists, right? And they will say, that are followed by, you know, what we would call a catch-all provision, right? And the or otherwise is a catch-all provision. Mm-hmm. So it's a fairly typical way of drafting, but frequently when you draft in such a manner, you would say something like, if there was a request put out for information, you might say, turn over all information, be it, you know, written, digital, electronic, email, you know, or stored in any other fashion whatsoever, you know, including but not limited to, you know, the proceeding. And that makes it very, very clear that you want everything, right? Mm-hmm. And that you are including illustrations so that when people, if people fail to comply with those procedures, you would be able to say, you know, and they might say, oh, well, you said you wanted everything, but I didn't know you meant email. You know, you would say, well, I included email in the list, right? So that's one mechanism of drafting. But the flip side of that is, I think, sort of implicit in your question, which is when you're trying to figure out what a potentially ambiguous term might mean in a contract, there is a canon of interpretation, which essentially says you should not read out in legislation, in a contract, here in administrative rules, you should not define an ambiguous word in such a way that reads out other words in the relevant passage, right? And so if you were to read otherwise as literally including anything, then that does turn that death or declination into a kind of surplusage, right? Then it really then what you're saying is that this provision should be read as is hereby authorized and empowered to fill any and all vacancies which may occur. Period.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Why would you need the words? I mean, I get the logic of sometimes you're trying to give the whoever's reading it more information, or you're trying to give less wiggle room so that people can't be like, I didn't think you meant that or whatever.
Right.
But in the case of this this particular block of legal text that we're analyzing here, it seems like the items listed are kind of like specific. You know what I mean? Maybe this is – I'm not sure if I'm making any sense, but they seem to be very specific and very contained. And therefore, I almost wonder if the otherwise – it would be one thing if they're like – vacancies that might be caused by death, you know, let's see, lightning bolt, bowling accident, like just any possible thing, like fatigue, sickness, whatever, then it might be one thing. But when you're just naming two things that are like kind of just extreme corner case things that might happen, it's not like, I don't know, does that make sense? It seems weird that otherwise would then cover or because you don't like the candidate and want to just kick him out or something like that. You know, does that make sense?
Yeah. And so let's tweak the factual pattern a little bit and it a very, very easy case, which is to say, suppose you had a candidate, you had Donald Trump fall into a coma, right? Mm-hmm. Then I think if you go back and look at this passage, I don't think there would be much argumentation at all that the RNC has the power to replace somebody who's fallen into a coma, right? Because that's pretty close to death, and it would clearly be contemplated, and it would be a vacancy that was created by an external force, right?
Right. But, Is that the difference? So, like, they seem to be external forces. There's nothing in that list that suggests you can create the vacancy yourself.
Right.
Okay.
And another clue. So again, right, in a situation where you have an ambiguity, right, the first step is always, is there an ambiguity, right? Is this something that when read straightforwardly using the dictionary definition or the industry standard definition of the terms, is there ambiguity or is it clear? And here I think there's an arguable ambiguity. So when you have an ambiguity, then you look to all of these canons of interpretation to help give you guidance. So, you know, additionally, you might look at the fact that rule number 9 has a header that is entitled filling vacancies in nominations, right? And there's no provision. You know this from a previous contract that we've discussed, Thomas, but there's no provision here that says, you know, the headers are for convenience only. So, so the header is actually useful in helping us to interpret where this belongs. And again, the notion of filling a vacancy is different than, you know, creating or changing a nominee or something like that.
You're saying it's an ambiguity. It sounds to me like that doesn't give the party license to cause the vacancy to me. But are you kind of just saying it's ambiguous at this point? Or are you firmly saying they can't?
No, I'm not firmly saying that they can't. I'm saying that I would lean in that direction.
Okay.
And I think that, you know, as you read this contextually, there doesn't seem to be a broad grant of authority to create a vacancy, even if you believe that the otherwise gives you a broad grant of authority in filling a vacancy. Now, what are we lacking here? We're lacking two things that we sometimes look to in trying to figure out what ambiguous laws would mean.
I bet our listeners can guess what those are.
Okay.
Just go ahead and guess. Send in your, we'll wait. Send an email. Yeah. No, I'm just kidding.
hopefully that's the case and that these will seem familiar. So number one, we're lacking legislative history. We're lacking the statements by the folks who drafted this provision as to what they intended it to cover. Uh-huh. And number two, and most importantly, we're lacking any kind of case law or precedent that tells us, you know, how this has been litigated before, because this Rule 9A has never been used. There's been a situation in 1972, the Democratic Party replaced George McGovern's initial vice presidential running mate, Thomas Eagleton, after it was discovered that he had undergone electroshock therapy, and he was replaced with Sergeant Shriver. But that is the DNC. They have a different set of rules. It was a pretty straightforward provision. There was no controversy, Eagleton voluntarily withdrew. Go ahead.
I think this is a time where I got to do my usual thing of asking incredibly basic, dumb questions that probably wouldn't have occurred to a genius lawyer like yourself. What are the RNC and the DNC? Like, what are they? They're not part of the government, right? Are they private entity? Like, what kind of, you know? So I'm wondering, is this sort of just a contract thing? Like, once they have these rules, they have to follow them because they're in some sort of a contract with us, with the people? How does this legal setup work?
That's a great question. They are private organizations. The parties are private parties. And one of the things that, you know, came up frequently in the particularly in the Democratic primary, it was sort of the notion of the fairness of superdelegates and the fairness of, you know, winner-take-all contests versus proportional contests and primaries versus caucuses and that sort of thing. And the answer is that this is a private body that is taking on some, you know, quasi-governmental functions here in the nomination process. And so what binds them are – there are election laws, but the specific procedures that the parties use to pick a nominee are up to the parties, right? Like there's literally nothing to prevent either party from promulgating a new set of rules and saying, hey, look, we're going to go back to the system that worked in 1936 and our party bosses are just going to pick who the nominee is and you're going to like it.
But let's say – okay, so in that situation – somebody can probably sue somebody though, right? That's the, so like if the party elites or something or whoever's in control does something that's against these rules that they've set out, who sues whom? Just wants to says this is a breach of contract of some kind or?
Yeah, I mean, that's right. But the way in which you would – the way in which the party would go back to the 1936 system would be to amend its rules, right? Would be to say, hey, we're no longer going to follow this process anymore. We're
right, going to follow a different kind of process. Right, I get that. But I meant, let's say, in a situation like – I get that they have ways they can do it that are totally kosher. Like, I get that. So they there's probably some – I don't know what – some amount of votes they need or some time period of – meeting and something or other to amend stuff. But I'm just thinking in an emergency situation like this, what physically, you know, like legally stops them from just kind of doing whatever they want?
Yeah. And again, what stops them are their own procedures that they've published. And what would happen would be Donald Trump would bring a lawsuit against the RNC in federal court seeking an injunction. And we talked about this in the last episode.
Ooh, injunctions. We know what injunctions are.
Yeah. That would seek to prohibit them from changing their nominee.
Got it.
And so that would be an order from the court telling the RNC, no, you can't do this.
So that makes sense. And you know, one other question I have, I hope it's a good time for it, but you mentioned that they replaced, was it the DNC replaced the vice presidential candidate at some point? Is that what you said?
Yeah. McGovern's campaign replaced Eagleton. He agreed to withdraw.
Okay. And, so that's a question I had because there's also simultaneous to the question of Trump quitting or whatever, there's a seems to be some tension between Trump and Pence right now. They're not in the conjugal relationship that they were when their logo was first announced.
Right.
They seem to be – there's trouble in paradise. I'm wondering now – Is that something Trump can do? Could Trump even say, Pence, you're out? Now, there's two sides of it. I suppose if your main candidate, if your presidential candidate says to the vice presidential candidate, like, I don't want to run with you anymore, I'm assuming that the VP would probably just step aside like voluntarily and that would kind of solve it. But I do wonder, crazier things in this election have happened than that. If Pence didn't want to step down and Trump was so pissed at him that he wanted him to, is there anything he can do? Or is it since the party has nominated them both, is it only the party that can do this kind of thing?
Yeah, it's the latter, right? It is the party that has nominated both Trump and Pence, and it's the RNC that gets to make the that gets to call the shots with respect to that. In any usual situation, right, the party is going to do what the presidential nominee of the party wants them to do.
Yeah, that's normal. We're not in normal situations right now.
Yeah, but no, that Donald Trump cannot unilaterally kick Mike Pence off the ticket. They would have to follow this exact same provision. Now, again, I think it's a different scenario. If Trump were to kick Pence off the ticket and the RNC wanted to validate that, right, that would strike me as more of a situation of an arguable vacancy that has been created by an external force that requires filling, right? In this case, the outside force would be Trump kicking him off.
Uh-huh. Assuming Pence allowed that, because like you can't actually, like if again, it's weird, but if Pence was like, no, I'm not leaving, there's nothing Trump can do, right?
Yeah, that's correct. He has no power to act unilaterally. His power comes from the implicit
the party wanting
idea
to not explode.
and that's right. And so, you know, you saw that, for example, with the Libertarian convention. Gary Johnson, you know, narrowly won on the second or third ballot. I think it was the second ballot. He was a somewhat controversial choice because he's not a doctrinaire, you know, libertarian. And he wanted to pick Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld, who isn't a libertarian at all, as his vice presidential candidate. And there was some thought that the delegates might revolt on that. They didn't. Again, I think because of the implicit political pressures of, you know, even for a party as dysfunctional as the Libertarian Party.
Eyes are on the Libertarian Party and their policies, for sure.
Yeah. But you know, yeah, I mean, you just don't deprive – I mean, it's one of sort of the longstanding principles is, you know, you don't deprive the nominee of – it's always been his until here, but, you know, his or her opportunity to name their running mate. And but that is just convention. That is – there is no legal mechanism that's available to you.
No reason to go down this rabbit hole, but Libertarian
good.
Party.
No, it's a good one.
No, I mean, what I'm going to ask, Libertarian Party, whole new set of rules, right? But who knows if they even have rules? They're like, we don't need rules. We don't need any sort of binding thing telling us what to do.
So that would substantially impinge on your freedom. So,
yeah.
So the bottom line on 9A is it's ambiguous.
Okay.
And the majority of scholars who have looked at it have concluded that it probably does not give the RNC the power to involuntarily replace a nominee who is not interested in stepping down or has not voluntarily stepped down or been incapacitated or killed. Mm. And the people holding that view are Josh Putnam, a lawyer from the University of Georgia, Morton Blackwell, an RNC member from Virginia, and Jim Bopp, who is an Indiana lawyer and the former RNC vice chairman. The minority position, that catch-all provision is broad enough to strike down Trump, is held by former New Hampshire Senator Gordon Humphrey. And also, I don't know if you remember Delegate Kendall Unruh, who led the Free the Delegates group at the Republican National Convention. That was the group that wanted the delegates to be able to vote their conscience rather than vote as they were pledged by the results of the various primaries and caucuses. And she put together a group. They lost. And then immediately after the RNC and Trump had that like really bad stretch where, you know, you had the Democratic convention, you had Trump attacking the Khans, the Gold Star family whose son was a hero.
Yeah, quaint to think back to times when that was his biggest problem, that he was doing some of the stupidest politics I've ever heard of in my life, which is after a Gold Star Muslim family. Anyway, those were the days of the Trump campaign.
And there was talk about replacing him then. And Kendall Unruh's group, there was a lawyer in that group that put out a memo that said 9A provides an adequate mechanism, even though we've just nominated Trump, you know, to do a takesies-backsies. So that's kind of the uncertain status of the law. I would say if Trump voluntarily were to withdraw, then you would have a clear application of Rule 9A.
Right.
But how you would go about persuading him to do that, that's a task that I think is above either of our pay grades.
Well, I don't think anyone's ever persuaded Trump to do anything in his life.
So now let's pretend, though, that one of two things happens. Pretend either that the minority position on Rule 9A prevails or that Trump agrees to step down voluntarily. So what would happen under this rule? What would happen is that the RNC would have to convene an emergency meeting. They'd have to give 5 days notice. And then delegates, representatives on the RNC, not the delegates to the national convention, but representatives who are members of the RNC from all 50 states, from D.C., Puerto Rico, Guam, American Samoa, the Northern Mariana Islands, and the U.S. Virgin Islands, all of those get 3 members who sit on the Republican National Committee. So there's a state chair, there's a national committee member, and 2 national committee members. Looks like 1 male, 1 female. Mm. Okay. So those 168 individuals all get together at this meeting. Each 3-member unit then gets to cast their votes, okay? And those votes are in proportion to the delegates that each state or territory had at the Republican National Convention.
Oh, okay.
Okay? So, for example, California has 546 delegates that were allocated during the primaries. So each of the 3 members of the California delegation to the RNC would get 172 votes at the RNC.
Mm, okay.
Right? And the smaller states would get less, right? So each of those 3 people get to vote separately, right? So it's not like all 3
they're not
have
bound
to
anything.
No.
At this
so
point.
You would take, you know, that 172 for the delegation divided by 3, that gets you 57.3 votes for each person. You tally it all up, and then you go back to the same committee rule process that got you to Donald Trump having the nomination in the first place, which is whoever they would vote to replace would need to get a majority of the 2,472 total votes, which is 1,237. it doesn't have to be bound to the primaries. It doesn't have to be bound to within a jurisdiction. It doesn't have to be bound to anything.
I was going to say, and could this be anybody?
Yes, they could pick anybody. And it was actually one of the difficulties with the Stop Trump movement before the convention, in that there was sort of no clear alternative around which you could rally, right? Ted Cruz is despised by everybody who's ever met him. And, John Kasich was Paul Ryan, who sort of said he didn't want the job and then, put out that like kind of campaign-y video. It would have been but I think that the thought process on Ryan was, here's somebody who hasn't run at all. Obviously he was Mitt Romney's vice presidential running mate, but he was not vetted in the campaign process. The strategic choice, I think, would have been John Kasich from Ohio, obviously. Mm-hmm. But he got like 100 delegates out of 2,400. So it would have been very, very difficult to rally around him. So, there was no clear person with whom you could replace. Here, I think, right, there's an obvious choice, right, which is to say Pence has been a part of the national campaign for a couple of months now, and he had, by all accounts, a really strong performance in the vice presidential debate. And I think it would be a no-brainer if the RNC were able to replace someone, they would rally around replacing with Pence, right? Now, whether Pence would accept that is –
I feel like he would, because I don't think he has as much to lose. I think he's the clear pick because he's already somehow made the calculation that way back when he accepted, he was going to get on the sinking ship for whatever reason. I don't know. I guess because it's not like a failed VP is usually well set up for the next election. But then again, I guess Paul Ryan kind of was if he wanted to be. So who knows? Maybe that was his thinking. Do you think there's a difference? I guess this is just political opinion now, but do you think there's a big difference in Pence's mind of, okay, I was willing to be VP to this, disaster of a campaign just to kind of get my name out there, but I'm not willing to lose an election for president? Because typically when you lose an election for president, you're done after that, seems like.
I think that's right, but I think if you were Pence, I think you would take the nomination and you would say, if it turned out terribly, right, if you get killed mm-hmm. by Hillary Clinton, which would happen as we're about to go through and explain, you would say, hey, look, I stepped in here for the good of my party and the good of the country.
Yeah,
and,
a little bit different than being a clear nominee and losing then.
Right.
Romney.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
There's one other provision. You've kind of hinted at it. Some folks on the cable news channels have mentioned the Rule 9 in passing, although I don't know that anybody's gone into it with the sort of depth that we've done here. But there's another provision of the rules that could arguably apply here, and that is Rule 12. And what Rule 12 does is allow the RNC to amend its rules, right?
Hmm.
And the way in which that works is the RNC's – there's a subset of the membership that is the Standing Committee on Rules. There are 56 members of that committee. And so the RNC Committee on Rules, Standing Committee on Rules, would have to pass its amendment, and that would require a majority vote, 29 out of 56. And then it would have to go to the entire RNC for a full vote, which would require to pass by a 3/4 margin. Okay. And then, and here's the real kicker, that the amendment goes into effect 30 days afterwards.
Oh, man.
So we are here on October the 9th. The election is November the 8th, which is exactly 30 days from today. So,
and by the time they're hearing this tomorrow, sounds like we missed our window.
Sounds like we've missed the window. But it is, at least theoretically possible to amend and expressly give yourself the grant of authority. But the problem is you're going to fall outside that 30-day period.
So they really needed to do that earlier. They could have done a no-homers rule on them.
Right.
Just no,
yeah.
Don't allow no Trumps or something like that. Or just a rule to be able to hand-pick somebody or something?
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, what I would do is amend Rule 9A, right? And put in a sentence that says, in the event that it becomes the judgment of the
RNC,
that
your nominee is somebody as ridiculous as, say, right. Donald Trump, like that right. level of ridiculous, then we get to step in.
If we can take another shot at our Bernie Sanders supporting friends, now might be a good time to do that, which is to say, I remember the tremendous amount of outrage that, you know, my friends who were Bernie Sanders supporters directed towards the DNC superdelegates, right? And it was, this is totally undemocratic and horrible and terrible. And, you know, and my response back to them at the time was, hey, look, like, are you watching what's going on in the Republican Party right now? Like, the reason we have superdelegates is to prevent the DNC from being taken over by a Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Does that make it hard? Now, look, does that make it harder for an outsider candidate like Bernie Sanders? You bet it does, right? And I think I've said this before, I was a Howard Dean supporter in 2004, and the entire party apparatus was geared up against Howard Dean, right? Like he imploded on his own in the, you know, post-Iowa scream. But the reason he lost Iowa, in my view, was that the entire DNC got basically the entire mechanism of the Democratic Party to unite behind John Kerry in late December and to stop Dean as the nominee, and they were successful in doing so. And I thought Dean would have been a stronger candidate. You could judge that historically, right? Like I think if we had John Kerry on the show, which by the way, Secretary Kerry, if you're listening, we would love to have you on the show. But I think if we had John Kerry on the show, he would say, yeah, I didn't run the greatest presidential campaign in 2004. You know, that's the price of erecting gatekeepers, is that it makes it harder for, you know, sort of truly insurgent candidates to break through. And, you know, the differential on that is Dean, they were able to stop Dean. They were not able to stop Obama in 2008, right?
Yeah. Well, the other way to prevent that from happening is just don't vote for these morons in the primary. That's how you could, you know, prevent a Trump. Actually, that's something topic for maybe my show or something. But I've been kind of thinking over, like, what would the liberal version of Trump be, and would we do that, you know? And it's interesting to think about. But I just think, bottom line is, even if we had gone with somebody like Sanders, yeah, sure, that's a wild kind of outsider thing for Democrats, but he's not insanely unqualified like Trump. He's not, you know, there's all these other things. Anyway, I'm sure I'm getting us off topic a bit.
Yeah, no, look, I think it's worth discussing. I mean, in my view, right, where Democrats have had prominent potential candidates who lack any political experience, I've tended to oppose those as presidential candidates too, right? So, you know, Admiral Wesley Clark was a figure in the 2000s. And if you want to make an exception for, you know, Dwight D. Eisenhower, you can, you know, but I didn't support Clark because he had never held elective office. And that's the only sort of prominent Democrat I can think of in the past 20 or 30 years, you know, who came sort of seeking the top job with zero elective experience. But again, you know, in conversations with Republicans, one of the things that I would frequently bring up is, do you remember your criticism of Obama when he was the Democratic nominee, which was he had a couple of terms in the Illinois state legislature and one, you know, 2/3 of a term in the U.S. Senate, and he lacked really the experience to go in and get the job done. And while that, you know, wasn't salient enough for me not to vote for him, like I think that turned out to be a pretty prescient criticism, right? Like if you look at how Obamacare got passed in the first year and a half of Obama's presidency, I think it is not a difficult argument to make to say, gosh, if he'd have had some executive experience, if he'd have been a mayor or a governor and, you know, had learned how to work with the legislature, then, you know, maybe this wouldn't have been, you know, such a debacle that it was, you know, sort of getting things passed and, you know, losing Massachusetts' Senate seat to Scott Brown, everything that, you know, the botching of the rollout and everything. Like I think that was a fairly valid criticism of Obama that, you know, he lacked the kind of experience necessary to come in and hit the ground running as president right away.
Interesting. But you're saying once they've made that criticism of him, this idea that they're all about a wild outsider, someone with no experience at all, kind of ridiculous. We need someone with absolutely no experience who knows how to run a business that his dad gave him. He couldn't even run his own business based on millions and millions of dollars in loans he got. Couldn't even do it well, but okay.
You know, the idea that high-level business experience translates into executive experience is just – I don't have words to describe how inadequate that analogy is, right? Like it is like the way in which you run a business is, you know, by fiat, by accumulating a majority of the shares and then, you know, making your wishes known. And maybe you have an advisory board and, you know, there are potential circumstances in high level mergers and acquisitions where you have competing interests, but on a day-to-day basis, you don't have opposition groups within your company that have their own source of political power.
Yeah.
You know, that have to be dealt with.
And you're just talking about like organizationally, you know, yes. That's not even to talk about like what you're actually trying to do, you know, make a profit versus in different ways than you're trying to run the government. But
Right. I'm taking for granted the argument of, well, he knows how to get things done, right? and the way in, even assuming that to be the case, which I think could stand some scrutiny, that the way in which you get things done in business is just different than the way in which you get things done in politics. But I think we're a little
sure. Let's get back to it.
Okay, so let's assume we've passed this first hurdle somehow. We have convinced Donald Trump to step down, and therefore we have now convinced the RNC to convene, and they nominate Mike Pence and whomever Mike Pence wants to be his running mate to
How does that work? It's the same
9A, right? Okay. Like, because the provisions say...
Well, right. But technically, does the party just pick the running mate then, or does Pence pick his running mate?
Well, I think they would defer back to practice, right? Okay. They would call up Pence and say, who do you want to be your vice president?
But right? Technically speaking, they're doing the replacing based on 9A.
Yes. But again, they're not going to want to get into it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's already disastrous.
It already is a disaster. Good point.
So now let's assume they do that and then they replace Trump as the nominee with Mike Pence. They replace Mike Pence with, let's say, Chris Christie. Okay. So you have Pence Christie 2016. Now we're done, right?
Maybe. How about all those getting him on the ballot? How about
that's exactly the next step. And as you may remember from our Bush v. Gore series, which is episodes 2, 3, 4, and 5, although there are minimum federal election requirements, how elections are handled is conducted on a state-by-state basis. And so the answer is, in terms of who gets on the ballot, depends. You would have to go into each of the 50 states.
Oh, man.
And you would have to litigate in every single state. And you would have to seek an injunction to replace Trump and Pence on the ballot with Pence and Christie. And in 36 states, there are laws that require, in order to have access to the ballot, that the candidate be selected at a deadline, right?
Mm.
At a particular place in time. And in all 36 of those states, that deadline has passed.
Oh, geez.
Okay.
So then could you even count? Maybe this will come down to each state's rules. And of course, we wouldn't expect you to know every single state's different election rules. But where do those votes go? Let's say Trump and Pence are still on the ballot. I could see an argument of, well, you're voting for whoever the Republican nominee is, but I would also think like, well, if your vote is not going to specifically Pence and Christie, how would it possibly count for them? And it sounds like, would you have to write them in? Is that what you would have to do?
So let's get to that in a minute, because I have looked at all of those state laws, which are a little bit different. But before we get there, so the first question is, could you get Pence Christie on the ballot?
Okay.
And saying you can't get him on in 36 states, and then the remaining 14 states are Arizona, Arkansas, California, Connecticut, Illinois, Georgia, Kansas, Maryland, New Hampshire, New Mexico, New York, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, and Tennessee. And in those states, even though there's no fixed ballot deadline, the issue that you have is that many of those states have early voting, right? So Arizona, California, uh-huh. New York, for example, have all, we know they've already printed up their ballots because people have already mailed back in ballots.
Yeah.
So the immediate case that I would look to for precedent for getting on in the other 36 states is a case that involved the Senate candidate from New Jersey. And there, so there was a freshman sitting senator. His name was Bob Torricelli, Bob the Torch Torricelli.
what era are we talking?
This is he won in 1996. He succeeded.
Because that was an old timey sounding nickname. I wasn't sure if you were talking like
30s. I thought it was kind of a mafia sounding nickname.
Yeah.
That is a statement of opinion. That is no
nothing defamatory. Yeah,
potentially litigious, Mr. Torricelli. But no, he succeeded Bill Bradley to the Senate in 1996, and then was running for re-election in 2002. And in the course of his re-election, it became known that he accepted illegal campaign contributions from six separate donors that totaled, I believe, $7 million. And the Senate Select Committee on Ethics issued a letter of admonishment to Torricelli. Now, he was never arrested. He was never indicted. He was never convicted of campaign fraud or campaign finance abuse or anything like that. But it looked really, really, really bad. This was New Jersey. It was a very, you know, it was a safe Democratic seat. And as we got closer and closer to the election and more of this information came out, the Democrats decided that they were going to ask Mr. Torricelli to step down. So it's a really analogous situation to the current situation. And the New Jersey law, still in effect, required 51 days, and Torricelli stepped down on September 30th. So again, right about this time, with only 34 days left till Election Day. And so that New Jersey statute, let me read it to you, said, in the event of a vacancy, howsoever caused, among candidates nominated at primaries, which vacancy shall not occur later than the 51st day before the general election, or in the event of an inability to select a candidate because of a tie vote, blah, blah, blah. One, in the case of the office to be filled by voters of the entire state, the candidates shall be selected by the state committee of the political party wherein such vacancy has occurred. And relevant subsection D, a selection made pursuant to this section shall be made not later than the 48th day preceding the date of the general election, and statement of such selection shall be filed with the Secretary of State. So that looks pretty strongly like you've got to know within 51 days and you have to have a replacement candidate within 48 days, right? Yeah. Well, the New Jersey Supreme Court decided differently. They ruled 7-0. So what happened, exact same situation that I described before, the Democratic Party went, they filed seeking an injunction to stop the state from printing ballots with Torricelli's name on it and replace him with their preferred candidate, Frank Lautenberg. And so they filed for an injunction and the New Jersey Supreme Court granted the injunction. And said that they were guided by the principle that election laws are to be liberally construed so as to effectuate their purpose. They should not be construed so as to deprive voters of their franchise or so as to render an election void for technical reasons. And they distinguished that New Jersey statute, right? We talked about how you go about distinguishing prior cases and laws from state statutes like New York, for example, that says the failure to file any petition or certificate relating to the designation or nomination of a candidate for party position or public office or to the acceptance or declination of such designation or nomination within the time prescribed by the provisions shall be a fatal defect. And the court also looked at and distinguished it laws in Colorado, Washington, and others, for example. So essentially, the New Jersey Supreme Court went out of its way to read that mandatory filing period as an optional filing period, right? As creating a safe harbor that if you get in before the 51st day and you replace a candidate before the 48th day, you'll definitely make it on the ballot. If you're late, then the question becomes, can you get on the ballot? And they asked at oral argument, they asked the petitioners for the Democratic Party, you know, look, what's your drop dead date? How long does it take you before you can no longer get the ballots printed appropriately? And the answer was, you know, next Wednesday, right? It was a couple of days. And then the court issued the order. And back then, this was 2002, there was less early voting, and the issue involved absentee ballots. And what they did was actually mailed out new absentee ballots to people who requested them. And the end result was Lautenberg replaced Torricelli on the ballot. Lautenberg won and went to the Senate, so is a senator from New Jersey. So that kind of represents, I think, the the high watermark, but in terms of what Trump would have to do. But now remember that Trump would have to win these lawsuits in every state.
And yeah, I was going to say, because that was just one state that where we talked about that.
Right. And that was New Jersey. And they specifically, called out states that have ironclad rules, right? Like we read the fatal defect in New York, and there's similar provisions in many other states where I think it would be very, very difficult to persuade the Supreme Court of those states that even though the statute says fatal defect, it doesn't really mean a fatal defect.
Would the Supreme Court be able to step in, because this is going to be like something that he would have to win in all, in every state? Would they be able to step in and say, I got this one, and rule on it real quick? Or is that impractical?
They would not. The Supreme Court would not be able to step in and issue one ruling, because this is really a question of how you interpret the laws in 36 different states that prevent you from having access to the ballots. Now, if there was if he lost, the Supreme Court could group together cases, right? If there was sort of an equal protection violation or something like that, the Supreme Court could group together similar cases and say, no, you made a mistake in interpreting your state law, right? That's what the Supreme Court did in Bush v. Gore, right? But that was dealing only with an appeal from Florida, right? It was not trying to consolidate together appeals from multiple different states.
It sounds like, yes, they could possibly replace him. They could use this Rule 9A. But at this stage in the game, the ballots will be the big issue, right?
Right. And here we can look to, again, the question you had started to ask is, what happens if Trump, so suppose the Pence-Christie campaign is now able to get to win in some states but not others. So you have Trump and Pence are listed as the candidates on some ballots in some states. Pence and Christie are listed as the candidates in others. Isn't there the possibility that you could just have the state count votes for Trump and Pence as votes for Pence and Christie? And here, the closest case that I can find occurred in Missouri. This was a 2000 Senate race between Mel Carnahan, the former governor of Missouri, and John Ashcroft, hero of the religious right, later attorney general under George W. Bush. So you may be able to tell where this case is going. And Mel Carnahan died with 6 weeks left to go in the election. And the state party basically said, we're going to replace him with his widow, Jean Carnahan, and we're going to construe a vote for Mel as a vote for Jean. Huh. In fact, that worked. And Jean Carnahan won 1,075,872 to 1,039,409. The wrinkle here is that absentee ballots that were cast for Mel Carnahan were not counted as Jean Carnahan.
That's weird.
Right? And the same thing happened in Minnesota.
Why is that? Why weren't they? That doesn't seem like it'd be easier to count those.
Yeah, you would think. Again, it's a question of state by state application of the laws. So again, you think you have an analogy for removing Trump, but the reason why the analogy breaks down when you move from a Senate election to the presidential election has to do with the way in which we vote for president, which is codified by the 12th Amendment of the Constitution and by the U.S. Federal Elections Law 3 U.S.C. 1. Both of these, again, a shameless plug for our Bush v. Gore episodes, which I think are really good.
Yeah, they are very good.
Episodes 2 through 5. So most people know that when you vote for president in your state, you are not actually voting for president. You are voting for a slate of electors, and that those electors go and convene a meeting of the Electoral College, and then the electors submit their electoral votes, and that's what counts towards getting that magical 270 number. And in the past, we have had problems with what are called faithless electors. That is, an elector on a slate that is bound to vote for the candidate who wins in that state, who instead votes for somebody else. So there was one faithless elector who failed to vote for John Kerry in 2004. Again, didn't matter. One faithless elector in 1988 who voted for Lloyd Benson, who was the vice presidential nominee, as president over Michael Dukakis, who was the Democratic presidential nominee. So, you know, these sorts of things have happened throughout history. Faithless electors have not determined an election in recent years, but you could imagine, right? Again, let's go back to 2007, right? It would take only a swing of three faithless electors to have made Al Gore president instead of George W. Bush. So the result of that is many states have laws that prohibit faithless electors, okay. Right? And here's – this is, I think, the fatal nail in the coffin, right? This is where our story sort of comes to a close.
Okay.
So the federal election law, right, 3 USC – the relevant provisions, 3 USC 4 says each state may, by law, provide for the filling of any vacancies which may occur in its college of electors when such college meets to give its electoral vote, okay? So that seems to suggest that you have – wide latitude to substitute Pence for Trump. Uh-huh. However, if the state has a law that prohibits that practice, that prohibits the practice of voting for a faithless elector, it would also prohibit having an elector vote for Pence if Trump is the name on the ballot,
yeah.
Right? Because that's that is literally no different in practical application. It's different in intent, but it's no different in practical application than voting for Benson when he was Dukakis' vice president as president, right? Mm-hmm. And there are 26 states that have statutes that prohibit faithless electors. You cannot become president from either party without the votes from these. And let me give you an example of the differing kinds of state laws, right? So let's start with your state. Thomas, California, which says This is state code section 6906, says the electors, when convened, if both candidates are alive, shall vote by ballot for that person for president and that person for vice president of the United States, who are respectively the candidates of the political party which they represent, one of whom at least is not an inhabitant of the state. So that says you're bound to vote for the party nominee. Now, could that arguably be Pence over Trump? I think you have a good argument there. But if you look at, for example, Alabama's statute, I'm not going to read the entire thing, but it says that you will vote as an elector for the persons named as nominees on the ballot, right? Mm. So they vary state by state. I'm not going to go through 26 different state laws because that would put
suffice to say, when we're talking about elections that typically even the biggest blowouts are not that big, really. One state or, you know, is going to make a huge difference, or two states, there's not much room for error here. And if the ballots are not correct and you can't have your candidate on the ballots or something in a couple states, it's pretty fatal, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, there are a number, of these state statutes that come from what would be core Republican states, you know, the states that you would need in order to, you know, actually mount a campaign for president, right? So, you know, maybe, okay,
you
fine,
could get
it's
lucky
not gonna
and they're
work
all in, blue or something, but yeah.
Yeah, but they're not. So the bottom line is any talk, and I think Republican Party operatives know this. So we basically outlined, you know, the three hurdles that you have to get over, right? Number one, you have to have the power to replace a nominee who doesn't want to be replaced. That's an ambiguous question, meaning that there's going to be a public lawsuit, right? If the RNC were to convene and declare a bankruptcy, Trump would sue the RNC, which is – I mean, you know, you want to talk about literally unprecedented. A president suing the party that nominated him is a fairly amazing, you know.
A presidential candidate, you mean? Or
yeah, a presidential candidate. Yeah. Thank you. It, you know, would be – the news coverage of that would be fairly amazing, I think. So you have to get over the step of actually – having the power to replace an unwilling – a nominee who's unwilling to step down. You would then have to litigate state by state, and I mean in the next couple of days, and win on liberal interpretations in deep red states of construing election results in order to get ballots replaced. It's going to be a practical impossibility in a great majority of the states. And then third, when you have – ballots that don't match the nominee of the party, you have this potential, these potential faithless elector laws coming into play in a majority of the states in this country.
Wow.
And so I think the net result is when you hear Republican Party operatives talking about replacing Trump as a candidate, they are saying we are willing to concede this election, right? There's no, and I mean that 100% sincere. They're saying we want to concede this election.
With, get with on a with slight the business amount of dignity. Yeah.
Yeah. And not have to deal with a month of people associating the Republican brand with everything that we have seen about Donald Trump. You know, that political calculation is also saying, and we are willing to accept the wrath and revolt of the
of Trump
large
supporters.
Part of our party that has supported Donald right. Trump to this point. You know, even though the answer to the question is I think, you know, sort of here are the hurdles and it's a really, really long shot. I think this is it's really instructive to know what it means when you see a talking head on CNN who identifies himself as a, you know, Republican attorney and member of the RNC who is saying the RNC should replace Trump as a candidate. What they are saying is, I think we should punt on the election, allow Hillary Clinton to be president and regroup in 4 years.
Yeah.
There's no other way to interpret that statement.
Wow. Or, I mean, maybe they just haven't listened to opening arguments, so they don't know that. Think there's some chance to fix it. Wow. Well, excellent, excellent analysis. Thanks so much for that. I think that pretty much paints the full picture. Sounds like, sorry, Republicans, you're kind of stuck.
He who questions training only trains himself at asking questions. What?
All right, and for today's listener questions, thanks so much for submitting these, by the way, Daniel Andrew Duncan asks, what are the varying rules on how federal laws get passed through Congress? I keep hearing you need 60 senators, but growing up, I had learned it was a simple majority in both houses. What is he talking about there? The different majorities you need for different things?
Yeah, and what he's talking about is the way in which the Senate has changed its operations in the past 20 years, and a lot of this comes from a policy put into place by Harry Reid when he was majority leader of the Senate. The answer is it still only requires a majority. I know it's hard to believe when you listen to CNN. It still only requires a majority in both houses to get a law passed. But in the Senate, there is a procedure whereby instead of voting yes or no on a law, you can vote to table the law. And that means to indefinitely postpone and consider it later. Okay. And in order to break that process, right, that vote is called cloture, right, to bring everything to a close, that requires 60 votes instead of 50. And in the past, what you would do as a senator is you would, if you were a part of the minority, you would filibuster, because the idea is when you don't vote for cloture, the idea is that debate is still continuing. And so you would have to have a filibuster, and that's where you get the like Mr. Smith goes to Washington, you know, people reading mm-hmm. the phone book, that sort of thing. But essentially, the Senate has agreed to, on previous question calls, to act as though there's a standing filibuster and not require the senators to actually come in and debate. So all of these bills that you see, you know, failing with 54 votes in the Senate or what have you, they're not failing on a yes-no basis. They're failing on a failure move the previous question and cut off debate.
Oh.
And the way to break that logjam is to change the Senate practices to require on votes to continue debate that they actually continue debate. That is, that we have a real filibuster. And why the parties have not moved to that practice, I don't know, right? Like that seems to me to be a much more expeditious process that, you know, look, you could still filibuster when it comes time to, you know, things upon which you really, really don't want laws passed. You know, you would then be able to pass ordinary legislation with 51, 52, 53 votes. I guess there is such partisanship and such distrust that, you know, neither party wants the other side to be able to pass laws with a bare majority of the Senate. And so that kind of inertia has kept it going. But don't worry, Daniel, you were not misinformed in high school civics. It still only requires a basic majority, but there is this procedural rule in place that the exception has swallowed everyday practice.
Yeah, wow, I had no idea. So they're just treating it like there's always a filibuster and therefore you need – wow, crazy. Yep. I didn't notice. That, see, people should be more outraged about this stuff. I suppose Congress has very, very, very low approval rating, so maybe that's part of it.
Yeah, that's true.
All right,
too.
Well, we got to get out of here. Thank you for answering that question. Thank you for submitting your questions, listeners. Very fun to be able to answer those. And they're great questions. I had no idea about that. All right. Well, that's it for today. Anything else before we tell people to stop breaking the law?
Nope.
Stop breaking the law, asshole!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
You love podcasts. The stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcast-free today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcast-free.